Hello, welcome everybody to the next edition of our speaker series. This is John Patika Jr. with the Patika Wealth Management Group over in Clearwater, Florida. And I'm accompanied with our senior member of our team, John Patika Sr. And as always, we like to try and cut out the noise of the mass media outlets and drill down on what we think is really important and bring guests in that are experts in their respective fields. And we certainly have that today. We have former Congressman Hensarling, who serves as a managing director and executive vice chairman of UBS Americas. In his role, he works with the firm's senior leadership and most important clients to help evaluate political risk and how public policy impacts their business interests and portfolios. Prior to coming over to UBS in 2019, he served in the U.S. Congress for 8 terms, including 3 terms as the chairman of the powerful House Financial Services Committee, which exercises jurisdiction over a broad swath of the nation's economy, including banking, securities, insurance, housing, and monetary policy. And in recognition of his economic policy expertise, Congressman Hensarling was also appointed to serve on the Congressional Oversight Panel for TARP. That's the $700 billion troubled asset purchase program set up in the wake of 2008 financial crisis. And prior to serving in Congress, Congressman Hensarling had a varied career in business. He served as an officer of both Maverick Capital, which is a well-known hedge fund, and Green Mountain Energy. Congressman Hensarling also earned a BA in economics from Texas A&M and a JD from University of Texas. Serves on the board of Cox Media Group and lives over in Dallas, Texas with his wife and children. And Jeb, I just wanted to welcome you to our call.
No, thank you. Pleasure to be with you, John, your team, and your clients.
Congressman, we'll get right to it. Thrilled to bring a different perspective to our clients. Normally, we'll have portfolio managers and analysts and so forth. Today, we're going to go at some of these questions from a government policy angle. And you being 16 years on the Financial Service Committee and some closed door meetings with 4 different Fed chiefs, I think that's a unique perspective that we've not had here. And to remind people that the Financial Service Committee does oversee one of its many things, monetary policy. So, you know, I think we'd start in banking, securities, housing, insurance, so forth. So I'd like to get started with, I grew up in 1970s Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I saw an inflation. I saw what energy problems can do to good, hardworking people. I'd like you to just tell me about inflation. How's this going to play out? How's the policy going to go? You've been through this. Tell me how you think it's going to go.
Well, I think we all know that the unfortunate headline from yesterday was highest rate of inflation in 40 years, hearkening back to that period of which you spoke. I guess the bottom line is that I think we know the Federal Reserve that controls our money supply has dropped the term transitory from their lexicon. And I think that is wise because I don't believe this inflation is going to prove to be transitory over any kind of medium period or long term period time frame. So I do think that we will see lower inflation levels than certainly the 7.9% CPI that we just saw come in for last month. But I could see a time where there could be 2, maybe 3 years of inflation in the 3 to 5% range. And I can kind of talk you through why I believe that. So forgive me, I don't know the various callers, the various participants in the call, how much they know about the Federal Reserve. So the Federal Reserve, our central bank, ever since 1974, has had what we call a dual mandate to help bring about full employment and stable prices. They've never really defined full employment. They have defined stable prices as 2% inflation. And for years and years, inflation has lagged behind their target. They attempt to achieve their target through what are known as open market operations, where they go into our treasury markets short term and do buying and selling because they have a target interest rate they're aiming for. And so they fluctuate, but they try to impact supply and demand. So that's how the Federal Reserve operated for years and years and years up until 2008. The last financial crisis, and then all kinds of new tools came into the toolbox, including something called quantitative easing. I can assure you, Washington is full of interesting vocabulary and acronyms that are difficult for people who don't live their life in this to understand. At that point in 2008, the Federal Reserve started buying huge, huge portions of longer-term treasuries to try to impact asset values and to really drive down long-term interest rates to promote more economic growth. And their balance sheet represents, among other things, the number of treasuries that they have purchased. And so their balance sheet ballooned from less than $1 trillion to $4 trillion. And at that time, they were backstopping certain markets. So fast forward to where we are today, we know that we have now seen the greatest monetary and fiscal stimulus in the history of our republic. So most would argue that certainly a lot, perhaps most, perhaps all of this fiscal and monetary policy with stimulus was necessary, but it is not free. It does come with a cost, and the cost is what we are seeing now to a significant extent. And so, John, what we have heard as the Fed tries to achieve their 2% their 2% inflation target, the 2% is not a hard target. It is not a ceiling. A number of years ago, they decided, you know what, we will have an average target. So if inflation consistently comes in below 2%, it's okay for a few years if it runs a little hot at 3% or 4%. Bottom line is they never anticipated that they would see inflation levels at these levels. So within kind of monetary policy debate, political debate, you hear people constantly talk about supply chain challenges, COVID challenges, and all of that is true. All of that certainly has an impact on inflation. But what also has an impact on inflation is when Congress put in an unprecedented almost $6 trillion into the economy almost overnight. They did that with debt because we have not only the highest inflation rates we've had in 40 years, we have the highest national debt we've had in the history of the republic. So to fund all that, they have to do it on credit. To do it on credit, they once again have to go to the treasury market. And in this point, foreigners and private investors did not want to buy the bulk of that debt. So instead, the Federal Reserve buys the lion's share of that debt. Well, how do they buy it? They buy it by figuratively printing money. Now, in a more literal sense, what they do is they go into the market and buy these treasuries from typically large banks known as primary dealers. And once they buy those, they just do a bookkeeping entry and say, okay, we just bought, you know, $100 billion of treasuries from you, and we're just going to make a bookkeeping entry that you now have $100 billion on reserve at the Federal Reserve. Well, that money didn't exist. They just created it. And that's one of the reasons that now the Federal Reserve's balance sheet has ballooned from $4 trillion to $8 trillion. Now, That money necessary to fund all this COVID relief would not have necessarily led to kind of medium-term inflation had it been purchased by third parties. But it had to be purchased by the Federal Reserve because there was insufficient demand, and that means money was created. So, yes, is there a transitionary aspect to current inflation? Absolutely. But ultimately, inflation is a monetary policy phenomenon. And I think this inflation is going to run hot for a while, John, for a number of different reasons. Reason number one, the Federal Reserve is clearly behind the power curve. Again, they never anticipated this level of inflation. And it's always easy to second guess the Federal Reserve, but one of the ways to second guess them is, why did you overshoot? Why did you purposely overshoot your 2% target? Why was that an average as opposed to a ceiling? Because now you have way overshot your target. So number one, they probably had what we call a policy mistake by having embedded in their policy overshooting their 2% target. Point number one. Point number two, there is a lag time for monetary policy to work its way through the economy and ultimately impact interest rates, the money supply. So not only did they vastly overshoot it, whatever they do today is going to take a while to go through the economy. The next point I would make is clearly all what we call Federal Reserve governors have stated that they want to render inflation out of the economy. I would say that there are several today openings, if you will, vacancies at the policy making level of the Federal Reserve. So President Biden has nominated three new people to the Board of Governors. Now, many would argue they're highly qualified, academics, they've got Treasury experience, they have Federal Reserve experience. But what they would all have in common is that they are known as monetary policy doves. So there's kind of this dichotomy. You're either a dove or you're a hawk. A hawk is very concerned about inflation, and a dove is very concerned about employment. So, John, I think there'll be a bias if these new nominees are confirmed, even though they know they have to render inflation out of the system. They have a natural bias in wanting to run the inflation a little hot so that labor markets are tight so that wages will go up. Now, we are seeing that to a great extent today, but there will be that bias in the system. So for a number of reasons that I've mentioned, there is a monetary policy phenomenon to this. I can see inflation rates coming down, but I can also see them staying well elevated beyond the typical 1.5% that we've seen. So the Fed's going to have a very delicate balance. They have all this money on reserve, and if they, again, let it all into the economy, you're going to see inflation levels remain at a very heightened level. On the other hand, to keep it out of the economy, they're going to have to pay these big banks, these primary dealers, high rates of interest to keep that money out of the economy. Well, that's going to drive interest rates up even further, which means that you have a heightened probability of throwing the economy into a recession. So it's the old Goldilocks dilemma. Is monetary policy going to be too hot? Is it going to be too cold? Or is it going to be just right? So I would argue that this COVID debt is episodic. But once you get past that, our national debt continues to grow. It grows exponentially. And that means that if foreign interest, if domestic investors don't buy the lion's share of our debt, the Federal Reserve is probably going to step in, buy it, create more money, leading to even more inflation. So forgive me, that was a very long explanation, but in other client conversations I have, inflation is certainly top of mind in the role of the Federal Reserve in all of this.
Yeah, Jeb, I appreciate the explanation on how money is printed. People throw that term around and don't understand. In fact, I called you the other day to explain how money is printed. And that's as good of an explanation as I've seen. But what I really want to know is, you work with four different Fed chiefs. You've had closed door meetings with the current Chairman Powell. Is this guy strong enough to do what it takes to fight off the political instincts and get this inflation stopped before it gets out of hand, and then you have to do a Paul Volcker thing? What do you think?
Well, one, John, I must admit, I'm a little biased. I know him personally. I had a good working relationship with him when I was chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. I would say, again, it's much easier to be in the stands and criticize than it is to be on the field of play. Having said all that, I simply repeat that I think that the Fed vastly underrated what they were doing when they took off their 2% inflation ceiling and made it an average target. I think the Fed also made a mistake in feeling, and to some extent they make this mistake today, John, and that is they have not admitted that there is a monetary policy aspect to the inflation. So even though they and Chairman Powell have dropped the term transitory, if you look very closely, I think that's what they still believe. They just think that supply chain, to normalize supply chains, is going to be far more time consuming than they had thought. They had not predicted the COVID spike. Well, you know, who can unless you're a virologist or epidemiologist? But they really haven't admitted that there's a monetary policy mistake, and I think that is a mistake. Now, do you ask, does Chairman Powell have the backbone to render inflation out of the system? My assessment of him from having worked with him would be yes, but I got to offer a caveat, and I alluded to that. Number one, typically the chairman of the Federal Reserve works with other board members to reach a consensus before they change policy. Well, they have had at least one governor, Lael Brainard, who has publicly dissented. Now, that's unusual, but it has happened over the last couple to several years. Now, as I alluded to earlier, no matter how qualified they are, Chairman Powell has some doves coming onto the board, and if they are confirmed, they won't necessarily follow his leadership. So again, consensus has typically been the modus operandi of the Federal Reserve, not necessarily so today. So as a group, will Chairman Powell necessarily get his way? I say that's an open question. And I'll also say by working with him and Chairman Bernanke and Chairman Yellen, it's clear that they all fear deflation a lot more than they fear inflation. So that's also a bias at the Fed. Now, Chairman Powell has essentially said that he wants to ensure that inflation psychology doesn't get embedded, this kind of wage price spiral. But he also said, you know, Fed policy, Federal Reserve policy, is basically going to be made in real time. And then it's going to be a very long road to normal. And so, you know, if people followed his leadership, does he have the backbone to do this? I would say yes. But whether or not they follow his leadership, I don't know. And the fact that they're so far behind the power curve and there's a lag in the impact of monetary policy, again, it could take some while to render this out of the economy.
Thanks. One last thing on inflation. This Build Back Better plan, they declare that that's supposed to be, you know, would not be inflationary. Do you think that, you've been around a long time, is that dead or are they going to bring it back in pieces? How do you think that thing's going to play out this year?
I would still say that there is a probability it will come back I don't think they would break it up into component pieces because of Senate procedural rules. The term reconciliation may be known by the clients we have on the line. My guess is many of them were happily ignorant of the term in a legislative context 6 months ago. But that's the process by which the Senate can move legislation on a simple majority basis as opposed to a usual supermajority basis. So you only get a couple of bites at the apple. And so I think because of that, if there is a bill, when there is a bill, that you would probably not see it broken into its component parts, because I don't think the Democratic majority can really count on any Republican help. And I don't ever recall in my political career, maybe in my lifetime, where I have seen a political party attempt a bolder agenda with a thinner majority, very thin majorities, tied Senate, as you know. So I think the probabilities are you would see it in one piece. So let me say in a bit of humility, if we would go back 5 or 6 months ago, I was telling clients I thought there was a 3 out of 4 chance you would see the Build Back Better bill, say that 4 times real quick, get passed into law with the attendant tax increases. But I also said if for some reason they couldn't get it done in calendar year 2021, the probabilities start to decline and decline fairly dramatically with each passing week, each passing month. So today, as most people may know, Senator Manchin of West Virginia is the big holdup. And he has really developed a real concern over inflation. There were other aspects of the policy he did not like, although he was pretty well satisfied with the original tax bill. So he's holding it up. He says, I want to start from a blank sheet of paper. I think at this point that most Democrats will take whatever they can get from him so they can at least advance their desired policies a little bit. And also, given that the midterm elections are looming, they want to be able to say we accomplished something. And right now, they can pretty well point to the bipartisan infrastructure bill as a major achievement. But they don't really have other major achievements, I believe, that the voters would recognize, understand, or appreciate. So I still think there could be a bill probably lower than the $1.5 trillion. And then, John, what most UBS clients I speak to care about, what's going to happen to my taxes? If you look at the last tax bill that was actually passed out of the House as part of the Build Back Better bill, most of what UBS clients feared didn't make it into the bill. Increase in marginal rates, increase in capital gains rates, ending of stepped up basis in estate planning, a wealth tax. Most of that did not end up to it. On the individual side, it was essentially a surtax on those with $10 million incomes, a greater surtax on those with 25 plus. So that would impact very high net worth and income in clients and those who may be having a liquidity event, you know, built a business, getting ready to sell it. And so that's an important point to let our clients know. There's still a possibility you could see a tax bill in this year, and you're planning some kind of significant liquidity event that could trigger this surtax. All things being equal, you may want to consider the timing of your transaction. So, John, I'm not a Vegas bookie. I'm not sure I want to give odds on this, but I can tell you this much. Notwithstanding the fact you saw headlines right before Christmas saying Senator Manchin kills off Build Back Better bill, you know, to paraphrase Mark Twain, the rumors of its demise are at least slightly exaggerated. And I would say certainly less than 50-50 chance. But the chances of a tax increase are not dead.
Thanks, Jeb. I want to turn to energy. Next couple of questions, maybe you can kind of focus in on energy. Is Russia really going to give Ukraine a 3 months warning and then invade and the oil prices go up? That kind of angle, what do you think?
Well, I will say this. Only Vladimir Putin, I think, knows what Russia will do. I certainly don't know what he will do. I will say when I was in Congress, I was privy to a number of classified briefings. Now, I've been out of Congress for 3 years and certainly hadn't had one since. But I still talk to former colleagues from time to time. And it is clear that Putin, in some respects, wants to regain the glory days of Imperial Russia and the Soviet Union. And so what he doesn't necessarily do on a de facto basis is not necessarily looking at reannexing these countries, but he wants to either have satellites, puppets. He wants to intimidate his neighbors. And what he also wants to do, John, is divide NATO and figure out ways to splinter it, make it less unified. So whether or not he goes in to Ukraine, I don't know. Certainly, he's prepared to do it. And if he goes into Ukraine, it doesn't necessarily mean that he's going to Kiev. It doesn't mean he'll necessarily go that far. But I do think that he does care to intimidate. He cares to split. And as you know, this Nord Stream 2 pipeline, where Germany is dependent on 40% of their gas and energy from Russia, and Europe writ large, roughly 25%, it's kind of mutual assured destruction because that's where all of Russia's, so much of Russia's income and foreign reserves come from. And on the other hand, as high as energy prices are in Europe already, they could spike even further. The last thing I would say, John, is I don't believe that markets have necessarily priced in what a partial invasion or full invasion could do to really spike energy prices and put recessionary pressures, certainly on the economies of the EU and having ramifications within the U.S.
Okay. Moving quickly, I think, in my opinion, Iran is the biggest problem, potential problem in the world if they start trouble. What do you think about this deal that we're trying to cut with Iran, and how do you think that might play out?
I think it's a little difficult to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. So Iran has really moved on with their nuclear program. And I think to some extent, obviously, they would like the sanctions lifted, but they've had a number of years to start doing workarounds. I think it's going to be very difficult to reconstitute something. And I think their breakout time to having battle-ready nuclear weapon, that breakout time has really shrunk. So I think that's going to be hard to put back together. I will say this, again, based on my service in Congress, I don't think there's any way, shape, or form that Israel is going to allow Iran to do that. And if Israel moves, although a number of Arab countries would publicly condemn the move, they would privately applaud the move. But again, that can have huge ramifications. And frankly, if for some reason these sanctions were lifted, that's a whole lot more oil that's coming on to the marketplace, and that's going to impact, for example, domestic producers.
Interesting. We're running low on time, but and you could talk China probably all day, but maybe say a couple of words on how you see China playing out on the world stage the rest of this year.
Well, I don't know how many rock and roll fans we have on the line. You may recall the Who song, Meet the New Boss, Same as the Old Boss. Well, Meet the New China Policy, Same as the Old China Policy. So I think that President Biden wants to operate on a more multilateral basis than President Trump did. I think certainly the tone has changed, but really the policy hasn't. Very strong containment. If anything, you could argue President Biden is even stronger on China on the Taiwan issue. So I think we are in a protracted economic cold war with China. All the political power centers in the U.S., be it those who care about defense, human rights, climate change, expropriation of our intellectual property and technology, John, there are a few bipartisan issues in Washington. Fear and distrust of China is one of them. So I think you'll continue to see more onshoring and nearshoring. I think you will see greater export controls, greater controls on foreign direct investment from China. I've met a lot of the high-ranking Chinese officials in my service in Congress. Never did meet President Xi, but I can tell you, at least on television, he looks fairly healthy, and he is moving China in a far more authoritarian trajectory. And so I think this friction is going to contend for quite some time. But I'd also say, unless there's a real overt move on our part, China does not want to get into a shooting war with us. Not today. They want to saber rattle. They want to use their economic power to get their way and put their imprint on the world order. But I would put a very low probability factor of ending up with a shooting war in Taiwan. But we will continue to see our economies disengage, but that's going to be a very expensive, cumbersome, time-consuming process.
I wish we had more time to talk about that. Maybe next time. How about something that you really got involved in for 8 terms in Congress? We're all familiar with past, you know, history of midterm elections, but what's your thought on this one coming up?
You know, what do you think? I'd say as of today, Republicans stand a very high probability of taking the House. I would say the Senate is much more of a toss-up. The Democrats are really in a deep hole politically. The president's approval rating and what we call the real clear politics averages a number of polls has dropped below 40%. That's a real drag on the ticket in November. What we call right track, wrong track for the country, underwater, not good. What we call generic ballot. If the election were held today, would you vote for a Democrat or a Republican? Well, in the 16 years I was in Congress, that averaged about a 3 or 4 point Democratic advantage. Today, it's about a 3 or 4 Republican point advantage. This is a reapportionment, redistricting year. Court cases will always intervene, but otherwise you have more Republicans drawing congressional maps than you do Democrats, and shock of all shock, Democrats draw maps to favor Democrats, Republicans draw maps to favor Republicans. And then last but not least, you just have a historical tide. Typically, the president in his first midterm, 8 out of the last 10 midterm elections, has lost seats, the average of 22. The Democrats on any given day have a 4 to 5 seat majority. So for all those reasons, not to say that Republicans aren't capable of snatching defeat from the clutches of victory, particularly the latest news of Republicans censoring Republicans, so they're capable of having kind of an internal civil war. And again, the Senate, you have more Republican seats up than Democrat seats. You have some pretty high profile retirements of Republicans, more difficult to defend an open seat than an incumbent seat. So again, for all those reasons, Democrats are in a deep hole. Doesn't mean they couldn't get out of it, but you'd have to see a real decline in COVID, real decline in inflation. You might have to see a rally around the president kind of moment on foreign policy. And you'd have to see the Republicans start to really self-destruct. By political standards, again, it's not impossible. Could happen. But right now, Republicans favor to take the House, Senate to toss it.
A little bit inside baseball. I kind of think I understand. These committee assignments are so important to congressmen. And it seems that's how the Speaker of the House, and that keeps their people in line. And they threaten to take committee assignments. Do they get extra employees, extra money? How does that work? How do they hold everybody in line?
Well, it really depends upon what people want to do with their congressional careers. But there is in both parties a group more or less called a committee on committees, a steering committee, maybe made up 25, 30 members of Congress, tend to be more senior members. And they essentially look at kind of applications, if you will. But it's still a very heavy leadership-driven kind of process. You know, the Speaker of the House, she's going to get her way 4 out of 5 times on where she wants to put somebody on a committee. And the same is true today of the minority leader on the Republican side. So it's very leadership oriented. It's unusual to strip a member of their committee seat. They are threatened. Other ways that you, quote unquote, as you put it, control members is, you know, somebody in leadership can say, you can stay on the committee, but I'm never going to let one of your bills come to the House floor for a vote. I'm not necessarily going to come to your district to help you get reelected, but it's pretty well going nuclear to take somebody off of their committee seat. And then so, again, once they get on that committee, very high chance they'll stay there. But members want to, you know, kind of move up the pecking order in their committees, or they may want to move to something that's more desirable or more prestigious. So again, they're going to have to go back to leadership. And one of the things the leadership of the parties are going to look for is how often do you vote with the leadership and how productive are you and how cooperative are you with your committee chairman? So those are all factors that that go into the choice of committee selections.
Wish we had more time. Any last, do you have any last comments before we're going to let you go?
Well, I would just say that, one, I'm happy to be here, and I just want to let all the clients know that, you know, UBS wants to make sure that we can help offer you guidance on political risk embedded in your business decisions, in your personal portfolio, in your estate planning. So be happy to do this again. And I guess the last thing I would say is, as divided and contentious as America looks today, and we are divided, and political speech is contentious, we've overcome even greater periods of challenge. So I would never short America. Somehow we're going to find our way back. But in the meantime, we can help you at UBS kind of navigate these very turbulent political waters.
Thank you very much, Jeb. And like our other calls here, this is recorded as a podcast, lives on our website, the Patika Wealth Management Group website. And you could also subscribe on the Spotify. We also have a newsletter called the Washington Weekly that gives insight about what's coming out of Washington from our Political Action Committee. If anybody wants to subscribe to that, feel free to reach out to the team. We'll get you on that newsletter subscription. And once again, Congressman, we really appreciate the time and your thoughts with us. It was very, very helpful.
Glad to hear it. Anytime.
Thank you, Congressman.
And this concludes our call, everyone. Have a great weekend. Take care.